So the term IKEA is a bit confusing. The international media took it because it attracts headlines. They took it to be like an abandoned rural property that's selling for like, a cent on the dollar somewhere in the remote Japanese countryside. But the term IKEA actually refers to any property that's not lived in, whether it's just vacant or abandoned, whatever the case may be. So, for example, if you have a multi-million dollar mansion in the center of Tokyo that's no one lived in for a year, that's technically an IKEA too, right? Or a condo unit that's no one lived in for a few years. So the term IKEA can mean a lot of things, and we have customers who buy different things too, depending on their budget and depending on what they're buying it for. So we had somebody buy a property that was over $1 million in central Kyoto a couple of years ago, and we regularly have people buying those dilapidated old houses in the countryside for 20, 30, 50,000 bucks, whatever the case may be. So the attraction there really depends on the person. Some people take it as a project, like a labor of love thing that they'll hand restore over a number of years, or pour a lot of money into restoring it to what it used to be if it was a very traditional, nice looking one. And some people just buy them to demolish and rebuild a brand new house because they're happy that they got it on the cheap and they got a cheap land plot. Folks, and welcome back to Nippon Trading International's Japan Real Estate Podcast. I'm your host, Ziv Nakajima again, and this podcast is brought to you, among others, by Emil Gorgis of realestate.jp. He's a Tokyo real estate agent who specializes in serving international or mixed nationality families who are looking for the perfect family home. So Emil's an Australian. He's been living here in Japan for over two decades now. And for about half of that time, he's been buying, selling, and managing real estate properties in Tokyo on behalf of his own family and a great many happy clients. And he also acts as a mortgage broker on behalf of his clients. So he's got dedicated loan officers in many of the Japanese mega banks. And if you're a regular listener of the podcast, you probably already know him from our JREP, the Japan Real Estate Experts panel sessions, which means that you're already aware of the fact that the man is an absolute fountain of wisdom on all things related to real estate in Japan, and in particular to family homes, the greater Tokyo metropolitan area, and mortgages. And most importantly, he's incredibly generous with his time and advice, which he's more than happy to provide at no cost or commitment to anyone asking. So if you've been thinking about buying your home in Tokyo, but you've been sitting on the fence for a while, or you just want to have a chat in English with a real expert, drop him a line on sales@realestate.jp. Hit him up today and start exploring your options. All right. Apologies for the radio silence again. I did try, but juggling ongoing remote work and trying to actually enjoy at least a bit of the holiday at the same time is proving to be a skill that I still need to master properly. So to have mercy on myself, I've decided to skip the recording and publishing for a couple of weeks, except to tell you in that one voice snippet, if you've downloaded that one, as I'll do again now, that tickets are now available for purchase to the Japan Real Estate Summit, taking place next weekend at the Tokyo International Forum again, and online. In case you've been living under a rock, this is the biggest and most heavily packed with information industry English event in Japan. Takes place every April and October, and is also the best place to meet, network, and forge business connections with Japan real estate enthusiasts, investors, big and small, more or less experienced holiday home shoppers, property professionals, short-term stay operators, renovation and maintenance companies, real estate agents, brokers, lawyers, accountants, and all other bilingual professionals related to the industry here. In Japan, the sponsors and speakers list this year is even bigger, which means most of us OG speakers have had to forgo our traditional breakout room session, but have no fear. We've reserved some slots in the breakout room, which is also our quiet break area this year, for private consultations with any of you who need those. We also have many other exciting speakers who will be filling these slots, including three brand new ones: Jacob Rashidi from Hokkaido Hobby Homes, John Cross from MailMate, and Rose Tipka from Your Family's Place. And of course, all of our OGs and returning sponsors and speakers: Robert Miller from Innovatius.com, Emil Gorgis from realestate.jp, Tracy Northcott from Tokyo Family Stays, Blanca Kobayashi from Arc Reform, Alicia Kin Wang from Axolotl Capital, Anton Warman from Japandi Design,
Chai Kanda from Shiki Properties in Kyoto, Daigo Sato-san from Sato Tax and Accounting, Nick Woolsey from Japan Remotely, Brett Lee and Shumatsu Post from Akia Hub, and of course yours truly. More than 70 tickets have already been sold by now. It's a week ahead of the event. This is normally the number where we stand around the last day or two, so it looks like it's going to be packed full of you good people this time around. No worries or FOMO, fortunately. We've booked a bigger space this time, but gala dinner tickets, which are sold separately, are limited to 50 people and are also selling fast. So make sure to secure your spot early if you know that you will be attending in person. And as always, we cannot and will not be selling tickets on the door. These have to be pre-booked by midnight 3rd October, or you will not be able to enter on the day. Streaming tickets, especially, will close for purchase even a bit earlier, and the Zoom links are sent out that same night. So do yourselves a favor, do not wait for the last minute, avoid disappointment. They're up for sale on realestate.jp/summit, which you can also get to from the top of our website, nippontradings.com. We look forward to seeing you at the forum next weekend or in the Zoom room chat if you're attending online, where you'll also be able to float questions to the speakers and, of course, liaise together with the other online attendees. So the next best thing to being in the room with us. See you all there very, very soon. We're very excited over here. All right, so for today's episode, a bit of a broader topic, although probably, potentially, let's say, boring for many of you, so don't feel shy to skip this episode. I won't hold it against you. I was contacted earlier this year by a young American Israeli student of international business based in the US, and he asked if he could interview me. I thought it was part of his curriculum because I have been contacted and interviewed by MBA and international business students many times in the past. But this guy, Ilan Falevich, is a bit different. He apparently wanted to talk to me specifically because of my personal background and also because of a deep interest and passion that he has for Japan and specifically its real estate market, apparently. So that was pretty flattering, and I'm a bit of an attention diva, so I naturally agreed. We talked about my upbringing, personal, professional background, the connection to Asia, my move to and life in Japan and in Fukuoka City, where we're based, what's that like specifically for myself as a foreigner and even more so as an Israeli, which then led us to also talk about the vast differences between Middle Easterners or Mediterranean folks like us to Australians to Japanese. We also talked about what I do and why generally, as well as went a bit meta and talked about burnout, how I personally avoid it. But then we dived right into real estate, specifically Akias, what they are exactly, where can they be found, how safe and insurable are they? Are they even investments in the classical sense of the word? How do we work and do business with Japanese folks? Why do so many of them try to avoid dealing with foreigners? And how we as a company work around that, how to do business in Japan generally as a foreigner, resident or not, so incorporation, logistics, setting up infrastructures, bank accounts, business relationships, partnerships, and a little bit about Japan's startup culture. And we even ended on a bit of a philosophical note talking about the future, the nature of making plans or not, and a bunch of other fun stuff. So not exactly your typical Japan real estate podcast episode, but might be a bit interesting for some or more of you. Have a listen if you want, and I'll see you again on the other side.
All right, and we're off.
Nice to meet you, sir.
Hey, me too. Yeah, so of course, thank you once again for speaking to me. I genuinely do appreciate this opportunity a lot. But yeah, so I mean, of course, the biggest thing I want to ask is like, of course, I also come from an Israeli background. You also come from an Israeli background too. Japanese and Israeli cultures, like, they could not be any more different from each other. So I'm very curious, as I'm very interested in moving out there. I have my own reasons, but I'm very curious of, like, what attracted you specifically to move to Japan, and especially in the countryside?
Oh, Fukuoka is definitely not the countryside. I think you don't really, maybe you haven't traveled in Japan much, right?
One time.
Okay, well, there's like 1.7 million people in Fukuoka City.
Oh, okay.
And the prefecture is bigger. So, yeah, definitely not countryside. It's not, but I wouldn't take it personally. Like, even Tokyo people who haven't been here much think like anywhere out of Tokyo is the countryside. Fukuoka City is the biggest city in Western Japan. So Osaka is slightly bigger, I think maybe 1.8, 1.9. That's the biggest city in central Japan. Fukuoka is the biggest city in Western Japan. And it's actually the gateway to Japan for anyone from Southeast Asia. So there are a lot of Singaporeans, people from Hong Kong, who come to Japan and don't even go beyond Kyushu, where Fukuoka is. It's a destination of its own kind of thing. I got into the country, kind of cliche, I married into the country about 2003, so 20-something years ago. I've been coming and going, and then eventually moved here. I moved from Israel to Australia in my late 20s, lived there for about 10 years. I guess if you're talking about mentality, it was like a leveling up or leveling down, whichever way you want to look at it. Like Australians are a bit more reserved than Israelis, but they're definitely very casual and not very Japanese or North European. I guess Japan's maybe more similar to Germany or Sweden or Switzerland, or, you know, compared to any of their Asian neighbors. It's very much an alien planet in that regard. I was drawn here again because I didn't know anything about Japan until I met my wife at the time. And then coming and going, it's easy to fall in love with the country. It's very different, but I find that a lot of Japanese and Israelis actually make a good match. I guess maybe they're attracted, or at least some of them, let's say more niche Israelis or more niche Japanese, are attracted to that unconventional style that the other culture has. But I think everybody needs to adjust. Like, Israelis moving to Japan cannot be as Israeli as they wanted to. And Japanese who hang out with Israelis, whether or any other international person for that matter, they can't be very traditional Japanese, right?
Of course, yeah. It's funny because, at first I thought Fukuoka, it's sort of like the southern part of Japan, right? Like, it's very like, much further away from like all the big, like massive cities like Tokyo, Kyoto, Osaka, all those. It's because, yeah, that's why in my head I'm thinking like, oh yeah, countryside, it's pretty far away from all that stuff. But no, it's really interesting because I did not know that. Yeah, it's like 1.7 million people. Also, but yeah,
it's about the size of Vegas, I guess, Vegas? If you want to compare it to something in the US. Yeah.
And then I guess also because a very big thing I saw is that you like buying and selling IKEAs and all those things when it's like. And I was curious, like, when it comes to, like, IKEAs and all of that, is that, like, mostly in the countryside, or is that also, like, in big cities, too?
So the term IKEA is a bit confusing. The international media took it, because it attracts headlines, they took it to be, like, an abandoned rural property that's selling for, like, you know, a cent on the dollar somewhere in the remote Japanese countryside. But the term IKEA actually refers to any property that's not lived in, whether it's just vacant or abandoned, whatever the case may be. Mm-hmm. So, for example, if you have a multi-million dollar mansion in the center of Tokyo that's no one lived in for a year, that's technically an IKEA too, right? Or a condo unit that's no one lived in for a few years. So the term IKEA can mean a lot of things. And we have customers who buy different things too, depending on their budget and depending on what they're buying it for. So we had somebody buy a property that was over $1 million in central Kyoto a couple of years ago, and we regularly have people buying those dilapidated old houses in the countryside for 20, 30, 50,000 bucks, whatever the case may be. So the attraction there really depends on the person. Some people take it as a project, like a labor of love thing that they'll hand restore over a number of years, or pour a lot of money into restoring it to what it used to be if it was a very traditional, nice looking one. And some people just buy them to demolish and rebuild a brand new house because they're happy that they got it on the cheap and they got a cheap land plot. And I mean, it really depends on what people are into.
Of course, yeah. I mean, because like it's funny actually, one of my first introductions to like IKEAs and all that was through Shu Matsuo, who I saw you did a podcast with also.
He's speaking at our summit next week, and this will probably be out a couple of months later, but yeah.
That's awesome. Yeah, no, because he's a YouTuber I follow a lot, and he's the one that kind of like introduced me to the entire like world of IKEAs and all that. Because of course, right now I'm a college student, I'm like studying finance and international business mostly. I don't really want to go on a finance route, really leaning a lot towards consulting, but real estate's also something that's always like really been passionate of mine. So yeah, I guess kind of like what you're saying about the media and all of that. I see on a lot of his posts, they are like at least from what I've seen, a lot of it is like in the countryside and sort of like run down and abandoned, which people then like to fix up and all of that. So I would say that is super interesting that, because not even I knew that, where it's like IKEAs are not just dilapidated, old, random countryside.
Interesting, you mean from a financial consulting perspective? You mean as an investment?
I mean, it's honestly in everything I say, like, of course, it's a very interesting investment because it's like sort of like out in the middle of nowhere, but it's like that. And then also just in the sense of like, where you're talking about how like the media covers like IKEA and like what it actually looks like to other people internationally. Because I mean, like what you're telling me that's completely different. It's the most viral videos I see online. There's an IKEA this, IKEA that. It's all in like these like crazy like rural cities.
Ghost and, houses.
Like,
the, yeah.
Like ghost houses like falling apart and all of that. Another thing too with like IKEAs and all of that is something I've just been wondering for myself. But so when it comes to like super like old properties, right? Like Japan is like known for earthquakes. There's lots of earthquakes throughout, I don't know, however many. But with there being so many earthquakes and IKEAs being built, like, I mean, some of these places like being like very, very old, what's the safety sort of like? Because I've sort of considered like buying one in the future also, obviously as like an investment. And but that's the one thing that kind of scares me about it, because I'm from California, I've seen earthquakes and all sorts of stuff too.
Well, the huge difference, I'll get to the investment part in a minute, because that's something that we'll probably need to expand on a bit. But with the earthquakes, the hugest difference, I'm sounding like Trump, the biggest difference between what you're used to in California and what it is in Japan is that here insurance is not an issue. You're almost completely covered in the vast majority of cases, and no one's going to give you any trouble when you make the claim. So if your house comes crashing down, you will get enough money to rebuild a new home. And if there's damages done to it, then the vast majority of those damages will immediately be covered by an insurance policy. You're not going to have to take them to court for it. They're not going to try to dodge the payment. And they're Japanese. I mean, everything is kind of done by the book here. It's not a very litigative society in the sense that, you know, you're not going to be insured, or if you are insured, then they're going to try to wiggle their way out of the thing to not pay you what you're owed. That's not a case here. So people are not concerned about that. From a safety perspective, yeah, but I mean, that could happen whether the property is an IKEA or not, right? I mean, you could be in the house when it, you know, when an earthquake hits, and then I guess whatever happens, happens. It's not a financial matter.
Of course, yeah. And then also just like being like a college student too, like right now I'm like visiting, at least I'm taking a class right now where it's like we study like a certain country for like 8 weeks, and then we go and travel that country for like 10 days or so. So I'm going to Korea, then Japan, and then
I just came back from Korea. Very cool place. I haven't been there before. This is my first time.
Yeah, no, I mean, I'm super looking forward to it too. But I was very curious also, like, out of all the East Asian countries too, of course you said your wife is Japanese, and now, like, of course each like East Asian country has like their own subtleties and their own differences. Aside from your wife, do you think, say if you did not like meet your wife, what do you still think you'd end up in Japan, or do you think you'd be in another like East Asian country?
It's really hard to say. I mean, I haven't seen that much of Asia. I've been to Hong Kong a bunch of times, Singapore a bunch of times, Japan, now Korea, Thailand, if anywhere, is the place that I'm most familiar with, except for Japan. And to me as an Israeli, actually, the atmosphere there is very familiar. I mean, it's hectic, it's noisy, people are in your face. The food is a lot more, I don't know, the flavors are a lot more accented, like Japanese, you know, flavors can be very subtle. So I feel very comfortable there. I can't really answer that. I don't know. I mean, synchronicity happened and I ended up in Japan, and now I'm, you know, I love the place. I don't see myself settling down anywhere else. I might eventually, when I retire, do like 6 months here, 6 months there kind of thing. But I can tell you what's why I keep living in Japan, but whether I would have ended up here or not without things happening the way they done is very hard for me to say. I just don't know. I probably would not have consider Japan as a destination if I hadn't met my wife and other Japanese people and gotten used to the country. But I mean, having said that, a lot of people, you know, a lot of our customers, you know, who have visited Japan once, like yourself, also found it very attractive. So I guess if I ended up visiting, I might have considered. I don't know. It's hard for me to answer that one. Now living here, I can say that I appreciate the space and the politeness that the consideration, maybe politeness is not the right word because it's very, it's ingrained in them, but I'm not sure how much they're doing it out of the kindness of their heart or just because they're used to it. It's hard for me to say. Mm-hmm. I mean, there's layers and layers of psychological stuff there, but the fact that people consider each other to the extent that they will never intrude on your personal space. They will never actively, I mean, for example, there's racism in Japan too, like there is anywhere else, but it's very subtle here. It's like a sly eye over the shoulder kind of thing, an empty seat next to you on the train, or people, it's more like people are scared, foreigner shy than, you know, actively in your face racist. And that translates into, it's just an example, like the same thing occurs here in every aspect of life. Like you don't need to, I don't know, walking, crime is one thing, but beyond that, you don't need to worry about things walking down the street. It's not like, you know, you're going to bother somebody or they're going to bother you. And if they do, they're going to apologize 1,000. So I appreciate that. Mm-hmm. I also, being at least financially, I'm kind of a conservative or geeky kind of person in the sense that I like everything to be super well documented, paper trail to the moon and back. I want to know exactly what my legal rights are. Like, for example, I wouldn't be a person who goes and buys property in India. You can make a lot of money there, but half of it you have to pay like under the table kind of thing, and then you have to work with local authorities and you know, maybe throw a few bribes some people's way to get you. I wouldn't be able to operate in that kind of environment. I like everything to be organized with checkboxes and lists and paperwork and whatnot, and Japan really satisfied that for me. So I'm feeling very comfortable living here and doing business here from those aspects, but the other side of that coin is that it can feel a bit restrictive after a while, right? So if like, for example, during COVID, when I couldn't get out of here for like 2-3 years, I felt the pressure. Like I definitely felt like I needed to just let my hair down, go somewhere. Where the other thing is that Japan, with the foreigner percentage being what it is in Japan, you're always on the spot, you know what I mean? Like you're walking down the street, everyone's looking at you. Like unless you're in super central Tokyo or Kyoto, where there's so many foreigners constantly, you know, you walk into a bar or a store, they're like, "Ooh, like a foreigner just walked in." It's a big thing, and that it's nice on a daily basis, and you know, it works when you want to try to feel special. But after a while, you do want to just mingle in a crowd and be somewhere where nobody looks at you twice, kind of thing. So it's a wonderful place to live in as a home base. For me personally, only as long as I can get out at least 2-3 times a year.
We interrupt this broadcast to tell you about Tokyo Family Stays. They're a short-term rentals company in Tokyo, and they offer a home away from home experience, which is just perfect for remote working, quarantining, if that's still a thing, or if you just need somewhere quiet to get away from the world. They offer a variety of options for families, corporate relocations, or even if you're simply transitioning between homes in Tokyo. The properties are super comfortable, tastefully furnished, fully equipped with all amenities, and they accommodate up to 10 people. So really the only thing you'll need to bring with you is your toothbrush and maybe a change of clothes. They come with fast, unlimited wireless internet, dedicated workspaces, and fully equipped kitchens. And they're just a delight to stay in. Fantastic alternative to Japanese business hotels, which if you've ever stayed in one, you probably know. They're tiny, they're noisy, fine for a night or two if you're on your own. But longer term or with a family, you'll probably feel you're in a jail cell very quickly in a Japanese business hotel. So if you want to give yourself a sense of space and freedom by renting a real home, with comfortable Western beds, including all the necessities like baby bedding, children's toys, high chairs, etc., you definitely want to reach out to Tokyo Family Stays. They've been at it for over a decade. They're a fully licensed minpaku or short-term stay operator. And as a special bonus for our viewers and listeners, they're also throwing in a breakfast basket upon arrival for anyone who books and mentions the Japan Real Estate Podcast or NTI. And not only for guests, if you're a property owner, you've got an investment property that you want to tweak for higher profit, or a holiday home that you want to rent out when you're not using it via short-term stays, drop them a line today, see how they can help you maximize your property's income. And again, as a special bonus to our viewers and listeners, they're also offering a free audit of your existing short-term stay listings without any obligation whatsoever. So feel free to reach out to them at tokyofamilystays.com. Well worth a visit. And again, if you're in the market for a family home in or around the Tokyo metropolitan area, Emil's your man. Don't be shy to reach out to him as well at sales@realestate.jp. And now, back to the podcast.
Of course, yeah. I mean, that's also one of the main things that also attracted me towards Japan. That's why I'm sort of considering like living out there. Is especially just the big thing, at least being public, just public safety, and also the just how well the transportation is. I'm not quite sure with Fukuoka. Is the public transportation like as good as Tokyo and like those areas out there too? Or is it a little different?
It's a smaller place. We don't need the complexity that Tokyo has. We have three subway lines and four or five train lines continuing at where the subway line ends, kind of thing, when you want to get out of the city.
Interesting.
It's convenient enough, but there are places here where you would need to take the bus to get to. Mm-hmm. And as soon as you get out of the city, like, for example, if you want to go to some of the beach areas or the barbecue spot areas or the hiking places, well, we do have a lot of, like, as opposed to Tokyo, where you have to travel for like 2 hours to get to nature. Here, everything is 15, 20 minutes away. Like, the city itself is, I mean, the public transport is convenient enough, but even within the city itself, anywhere you'd want to go to is at most a 20-minute bike ride away kind of thing. But once you want to get out of the city, then you might have to take the bus. And the more rural the area is, the less frequent the bus services will be. So you might have to wait an hour, 45 minutes, whatever the case may be, to get to the bus. They'll stop a bit earlier compared to the city. It runs here until midnight or a little bit after midnight. But once you get to the more to the smaller townships around Fukuoka, it might, you know, public transport might end around 10 p.m., whatever the case may be. So it's not as complex as Tokyo. It's probably not as convenient as Tokyo, but it's definitely convenient enough for living here, yeah.
Of course, yeah. And then also, kind of like what you were saying earlier, when it comes to, like, just being a foreigner and, like, kind of your place and, like, how it comes to fitting in, a really big thing I've heard just from talking to different people that are, well, at least foreigners who are living in Japan, is the quote that the nail that sticks out gets hammered down. And also another kind of aspect of it too is that...
Well, not if you're a foreigner, though. I mean, if you're a foreigner, you're going to be sticking out no matter what you do. You can't be Japanese. You're never going to be... You're always going to be an outsider to some degree. So that term applies to Japanese people who are behaving in a way that the other Japanese people don't expect.
So you kind of get like a little bit of a free pass if you're like a foreigner in like that regard. Like I've heard people call it like the Gaijin card or
Gaijin pass. Yeah,
Gaijin pass. Yeah,
to an extent, yes, but you also get singled out negatively for that, right? So people don't expect you to behave like a Japanese person, but on the other hand, you will face discrimination in a lot of cases. Like, you know, they're not going to say it again. It's not an in-your-face kind of culture, so they're not going to say "get out of here, foreigner." But they are going to find all kinds of excuses to not provide service to you, and the real reason is because you're a foreigner. So, even if you speak Japanese, like in my case, I have a Japanese last name. I'm obviously a resident here, but regardless, I'll still occasionally walk into a completely empty place, and they'll tell me that they're booked for the evening, and the real reason is they just don't want a foreigner in there, right? That kind of thing. Yeah. Or again, you take the train and, you know, the train is completely packed, everyone's standing, but the two seats next to you are empty. Right. So it's you get the Gaijin pass in the sense that it's not even a pass. I don't know if I can call it that. People don't expect you to behave in a Japanese way. So, but is it a pass? I don't know. I mean, you do something stupid and they're feeling like, oh, yeah, of course, stupid foreigner, nobody says anything. But, you know, from the get-go, they're assuming that you're going to be not behaving properly, right?
Of course. And then actually, kind of like when you're talking about, like, residency and, like, visas and all of that, from what I've been seeing, it's a little bit of a mess to try and get, like, a visa and all of that. So I was curious. You said that your wife is Japanese. So was that kind of, like, expedited because of her? And, like, also, on top of that, too, I want to ask about, like, when it comes to, like, getting, like, your first place, like, your first apartment. I've heard for a foreigner, it could be like really, really tough. But say if you have a spouse that's Japanese, like makes it infinitely easier because a lot of landlords are kind of hesitant when it comes to
renting a place.
Yes.
Yeah. Yes. Renting a place is one of the biggest challenges that foreigners face here. If you've been a resident for at least a little while and you're working for a Japanese company and you've got a steady
looking paycheck from a Japanese employer, then it's a bit easier. But obviously, they would still want you to understand what you're signing, and the contracts are all going to be, the lease and everything is all going to be in Japanese, right? So it becomes a little bit easier when you're a resident after you've lived here for a while. If you've just moved here, you don't have anybody who can be your personal guarantor, you don't have an employer who can vouch for you, you don't have a bit of an income history, then it's very, very challenging. And still, I mean, the legislation here doesn't allow for racial discrimination, but a lot of it's not being enforced at all. So a lot of real estate agents that you'll walk into will just say, oh, sorry, we don't have apartments for foreigners. They don't think that that's discriminatory in their view, right? And so that's very challenging. Purchasing is a lot easier, especially if you're buying in cash, because the seller just walks away after the deal. They don't need to deal with you, the agents as well, right?
Of course.
What they're really worried about is that, you know, the Japanese are, their psyche is very conflict averse. Like everything that's even a slight debate from their perspective is like a war, right? So they don't want to deal with misunderstandings and issues and, hey, you told me that, but no, I'm sorry, you didn't understand that. They just want to avoid that at all costs. They want everything to be as smooth and as expected as possible. And they will, in the vast majority of cases, leave a lot of money on the table to just avoid the hassle of dealing with anything that they perceive as troublesome. That's where it really comes from. So I guess it's a form of racism because they're expecting that any dealing with a foreigner will be troublesome. But it's not from it's fear, but I don't know. I guess all racism is based in fear, but it's difficult. Renting is definitely a challenge here if you're not a Japanese person. Yet.
Yeah. I mean, buying is a bit easier. I wouldn't say 100% easier. I mean, we've been at it for about 13 years with the real estate side of things, so we've kind of perfected our pitch. So when we contact a realtor for the first time, one of the first things we tell them is, we're a Japanese company, we're representing the scary foreign buyer, you'll never have to speak to them, everything will be done in Japanese the way you used to, don't worry about it. And then 80% of them, I guess, would be okay with that. Again, because the realtor and the seller walk away after the sale, as opposed to a rental lease where they have to deal with you throughout the lease, right? So it's easier, but there's still some reluctant. I mean, it's getting better over the years, to be honest. We now get contacted by agents who want to work with foreigners but need help with it. Whereas on the other, until about 5-6 years ago, we had to do a lot more convincing, but it's still a very insular society.
Mm-hmm. And then also, so, oh man, what was I going to say? When it comes to like your passion about like trying to get into real estate and this entire thing, I was very curious about like, because I saw you had like an IT background in the past and in the military doing like engineering, I believe, right? So
military, I went to a programmer's course and then I refused to sign up for an extra 3 years, which is what they requested for the certificate. So I didn't get officially qualified. I did spend my time doing IT work in the army or a lot of other stuff. But my background was IT, but I quickly realized when I was released from the army, I took a programming course, which is what I did in the army. I thought that's the way I'm going to go. And then I spent about 6 months working as an actual developer and quickly realized that I couldn't handle it because I need people, right? Like the environment of sitting in a room where nobody talks to each other all day except in occasional meetings was just not my thing. I stayed in IT, but what I found out that I really enjoy was dealing with people. So I went to project manager positions, department head, call center design and operation. So yes, I deal in real estate because that's what I knew. I was investing in real estate in Australia before I moved to Japan. So when I wanted to get a financial foothold in Japan, real estate was the natural thing for me to pivot to. But what I really like is dealing with people, solving problems, getting projects done, providing solutions to problems. That's really what attracts me. So I do it in real estate. I have another company that I started 3 years ago that helps people with other stuff. It's really the people side of things, not real estate, that I'm into.
Okay, so it's more like, because also I saw you, also you've done like some consulting work too in the past. Is that correct?
Yes. So I help.
Is that kind of like that
people,
too?
I help people with real estate. I also, with a new company, help people with
facilitating investments that are not real estate related in Japan. So, for example, M&A operations, people want to buy an existing Japanese business and run it themselves or expand it. People want to buy in as a franchisee into a Japanese franchise chain. We help people also with relocation support services if and when they move to Japan. If they have an investment, we help them leverage the investment into a visa in one way or another. So again, it's all, I like the position of bridging Japan with the outside world. And then everything else that I do is around that. It doesn't necessarily have to be real estate. Mm-hmm. Now, here's some big news for anyone interested in Akiya, the abandoned vacant homes that are abundant all around Japan for very attractive purchase prices. Akiya Mart, our latest sponsor, is a recently founded online search and discovery tool for Japanese real estate. Its user interface will be very familiar to users of Zillow or Redfin. The platform essentially scouts the internet for property listings, translates them into English, and displays prices in US dollars, all in one place and with a dynamic map interface that makes browsing, finding, and shortlisting your favorite properties a piece of cake. Which any of you have been struggling with the dozens, if not hundreds, of Japanese property websites that are available online and their very clunky interface will probably find a real blessing. They've got already over 500,000 listings on the platform, and the database is expanding daily. Ranging from abandoned rural homes to luxury urban properties, Akiya Mart makes it easy to find your dream home in Japan, regardless of your budget. Now, while the platform is essentially free for use, here's an exclusive offer for listeners of the podcast. You can use the promo code NTI to receive $5 off Akiya Mart Pro. The subscription will unlock a bunch of very attractive features for you, including unrestricted access to the entire nationwide property database and a whole range of filters, which will help power charge your search for that elusive perfect home and make it even easier. So hop over to akiya-mart.com. That's A-K-I-Y-A-M-A-R-T, akiya-mart.com, and kick off your search today.
All right, okay. And then also, I guess this sort of kind of just goes into like more life and things like that. So once again, so it's not necessarily like real estate, this, but just more of like the aspect of like working with people is kind of what like keeps you going and keeps you passionate about this. I'm very curious. It's like
globalization, and I like the concept of bridging between cultures. Japan is what I know, so I'm focusing on Japan. But I like bringing what, you know, making people understand each other's culture and making people, helping people operate in different countries, that kind of thing really appeals to me.
Of course. And then like when it comes to just like burnout, I was curious, like I've experienced burnout. Like I used to be a musician. I've still played a little bit, but I had like a heavy, heavy burnout. So I was curious kind of like, what have you like ran to like a burnout, and like, what was like your strategies for getting over it? Especially like just being in a foreign country where it's like, you're kind of just like in a completely different environment. And it's like, you can't, it's like, honestly, everything's just a little bit more difficult when you're just in a foreign country, I'd say.
That's a really interesting topic. We could talk for a few hours just on that. I've never personally experienced burnout, but I think that's due to two main reasons. One is that I really enjoy what I do. And if I find that I don't enjoy what I do, like what we spoke about with the programming a while back, I'm not going to stay in that environment for very long. I'm immediately going to start looking for something that just, you know, help me wake up with a smile on my face every morning kind of thing. Mm-hmm. And over the years, as the businesses that I run grow, obviously you notice more and more and more and more demands on your time, constant communication, especially in our case, because we deal with people in all corners of the world. There's no work hours, right? Like people will send you messages whenever it's morning for them, and you'll sometimes get it in the middle of the night here. So I've just learned to enshrine my private time, I guess, right? So I might, for example, in my case, and it's totally individual, everybody works differently, but in my case, I don't mind. I enjoy working until late every day. Like I'll usually be on the PC still answering messages, still preparing things for tomorrow until 11 or midnight or even past that. But then come Friday evening, I am not available, right? Friday evening to Monday morning, I'll answer urgent messages if they come in, or I might even just answer them to say that, sorry, I'll get back to you on Monday. But that will be the extent of what I do work-wise. If it's something that's not involving communications with people and I want to spend 2-3 hours to, you know, do some biz dev or prepare some presentations and stuff, I'll do it. But I'm not going to be available to the world during my private time. I really... religiously protect that. That's helped me not experience burnout, but I don't think that would have been possible unless I really enjoy what I'm doing. So the first one is the most important one, is only do things you like. In your case, why did you experience burnout with music? Was it because you didn't enjoy what you're doing? Was it because you constantly had to run to get money? Like, what was your experience?
I mean, my experience personally is that, I mean, I was doing it from like, I started in third grade up until like the end of high school, right around like senior year. So my thing is just that is all I did all day long. And it was part of like, it wasn't just like something in my free time. It was like my classes, after classes in the marching band and like all these different things. And it just took over my entire life to the point where it's like, I don't know, it just, and also on top of that too, is that I really liked it. That's one thing I realized, that it's a fun hobby, but it's not what I want to do like full time. It's not what I'm completely passionate about. What I found myself like really lost in, that's kind of how I got into business, was I started reselling sneakers. Like I would sell like Air Jordans and like all those like Supreme when that was like a big thing.
Yeah, I know sneaker culture. Yeah,
of course. Yeah, no. So I used to like sell all those types of things, and I just found myself lost in it, where it's like I'd be like just work, like I'd be working, and then before I know it, like 3 or 4 hours have just gone by. And that's kind of what I realized when it comes to, and I was trying to find that thing where it's like, I like business, reselling sneakers. I mean, of course you can make that a career, but it's not really what I'm looking for. But when it came to, like you said, I also have a passion for like bridging culture, especially. And I've sort of found in Japan, where I sort of found that thing right now where it's like, I'm researching like things about Japan, this and that, before I know it, 2, 3 hours are already gone. So that's my experience. And that's why.
And you never felt that with music, did you?
With music in the sense of like, researching,
like you, no, I mean, like when you get deep into it and then time flies, kind of
oh yeah
thing that never happened to you.
I felt that music too before, but however, I will say towards the end of like when I really started experiencing burnout, like end of high school, that's when I really like every single like marching band rehearsal and this and that, is like it felt like it was like forever, and that's when I was like, that's when
did
I
you get
realized
into
I had
it
a break.
because did you get into it because you loved it in the third grade, or because the
Loved
family
it.
said you should play a musical instrument, kind of thing?
No, I absolutely loved it. Like my mom also, I mean, she never really pressured me. However, she did everything she could to like support me and like make sure that like I was able to pursue exactly what I wanted. And of course, I think my mom's the greatest in the world for that. And everything I've done, like she's been super supportive of, but never really like forced me into a certain way though now.
I think I get it. Like I have the same thing with like, for example, one of my things that I really enjoy doing on weekends, again, getting really geeky, but board games, right? I'm deeply into that. I loved it. And since COVID, it reignited my teenage years when I was doing a lot. And then I really got into it and I enjoyed it so much. I thought, hey, I might do this for work, right? Or as a side business, let's see. And I organized a couple of events, like, and I mixed my passions, right? It was a board game and business networking event, like team building exercises, how we can combine the two. It went really well, but I found that dealing with the business of it was not nearly as enjoyable as just like getting into, like exactly what you said, right?
Yeah.
Like I couldn't even sit down and have a game or chat with people about business. All I did was running around and making sure everyone's having a good, like the event part of it was what I was doing the entire weekend, right?
Of course.
So I guess some things are just better left as a hobby, right?
Yeah, and I think that's what kind of what I realized with music, and that's like I used to play trumpet and drums and all of that, but kind of like with having 3 roommates, it's kind of tough to play the trumpet or drums as a.
I can imagine.
So I started playing electric guitar, and I mean, I have it like right over here. And so I just have it
Ooh.
sitting by my desk here. Playing a Stratocaster, absolutely love it. Whenever I just have some free time, just start like just strum, like play some punk rock, like Blink-182 and all of that. And that's kind of how I've kept that, at least right now, that's how I've kept that hobby of music and still having like that, just like that spark of creativity in me, just
You
even though
never
I
know.
lost.
It might come back in the future and it'll take a whole new spin on things, right?
It might 100%. And then also too, like when it comes to just like creativity and all of that, and like entrepreneurship is like something I'm super passionate about. And just because like I said, I started selling sneakers before, and you've obviously opened multiple businesses yourself. When it comes to the US, I mean, it is super easy. You just go, like, think of Secretary of State, file business, basically done. So,
Yep.
and then when it comes to Japan, I was curious because I know there's a lot of like paperwork is like everything just for any little thing. So when it comes to starting a business, is it a little bit more complicated there, or kind of what's the process like?
Technically, it's very similar. Logistically, technically, it's very similar to, I don't know, other countries, but what you're describing in the US. So you, I mean, I do these kind of things via professionals, right? Like I pay a lawyer to set up a company for me, but the actual process is very simple. It takes you about a month, I guess. There are forms to submit, and you have to show how much. I mean, yeah, but it's just formalities, and within a month you could have a company going. The trick here is, so in Japan there's a huge gap between official legal infrastructure and what actually happens boots on the ground, right? So the government poses no limitations on, for example, property purchase or setting up a business. Whether you're a foreigner who's residing in the country or not residing in the country, both are very simple legal formalities. There are no limitations on what you can do. But once you set up the company, so you got the government side covered, they allow you to purchase, they let you set up the company, and then you need to go and open a bank account or find a place to lease, right? An office, for example. That's where it becomes challenging because the banks are extremely, extremely conservative. Even for a Japanese person, I know, for example, a lawyer who during COVID didn't have much work and he decided to open a side business, something really simple and kind of silly. Like he was into table tennis. He wanted to open like a table tennis center, right? Where people can come and play ping pong. A lawyer, like 20, 30 years of experience running a private business in Japan in his field, and the bank wouldn't let him open a bank account for the new business venture, right? For why table tennis? Why, you're a lawyer. Are you money laundering? What are you doing? What's this about? And we, as foreigners, I mean, foreigners, expats, I guess, living in any other country, we always find the shortcuts, right? Because things are challenging and there's always going to be some issue because we're a foreigner. So, especially Israelis are very good at that. So, we find the workarounds and the shortcuts. So, I had to tell him that, hey, if you go to an online bank, here's a list of online banks that recently started working in Japan. They're onboarding compliance issues are a lot easier than dealing with a brick and mortar traditional Japanese bank. And he was like, oh my God, I didn't even think about that. And he opened, so it's boots on the ground. You want to open a bank account, you want to lease a place. Again, if you're a new business that doesn't have any income history, tax returns, landlords, whether you're Japanese or not, landlords will be, and the agents serving them will be very reluctant to let you rent an office. So long answer to make it short, technically not a problem. Logistically, you'll have to convince a lot of people to work with you.
I see. Yeah, of course. And then also when it comes to just overall entrepreneurship and startup culture, like for example, Tel Aviv has like, I believe it's like the highest startup per capita. And also I've seen like Tokyo too. It's sort of growing. And I mean, I know the economy is it's a little bit like it's struggling right now from what I've seen, at least online, and obviously the world economy right now with everything going on. But I was very curious, like, do you see a future in like startups in like at least Tokyo or like those big cities or even Fukuoka too? As even like when I was doing a little bit of research, like I see there's a very big international audience that's like sort of like showing up there because of this much like lower cost of living. And I mean, do you see like startup culture like
Plus, the mayor is trying to position the city as a startup capital of Japan. It's not near Tokyo levels yet, but he's doing a pretty good job at it. So it's got this reputation of being like a startup hub.
And I mean, do you think it has like a good future, like say like 5, 10 years now? You think it could be like up there with like Tel Aviv or like any of these other areas in the world that are like startups are like super common and like very much encouraged by the government?
I don't think we'll get to that level. That would take a lot more, and Japan is usually very slow to change, but it's definitely better than it was when I moved here, say 12, 13 years ago. So it was always a mentality thing. It was never an actual physical limitation or restriction. So again, opening a company in Japan is a fairly easy process. So anyone could have technically opened a Japanese startup at any point. The reason most of them have not been doing that, and again, that's improving now, is more, I think, more related to social norms and expectations, right? Like your parents will want you to, your parents, your peers, your potential spouse, if you're thinking about getting married, everybody wants you to go into a big company and have a stable salary until the day you die, kind of thing, right? So that's considered success. Startup is considered something that flaky artist druggy types do, right? It wasn't a thing here until 5-10 years ago. Now, because the government has been pushing for it for about a decade, they want to bring in foreign investment. They're trying very hard to make it more feasible, and a lot more people would consider that route now, but it's still very much a minority here, and it still has a bit of a stigma.
Interesting.
Now, if you've attended any of our recent JREP Summit events in Tokyo or online, you've probably heard our sponsor, Robert Miller from Innovatius.com. He's been in WebDiz Solutions here in Japan for the past 25 years, and he's also an active investor in Japanese real estate property, as well as global online property, which is his specialty and what his company, Innovatius, is all about. They offer a full suite of website services for entrepreneurs and small business owners, including all aspects of web design and management, backup and updates, content formatting and editing, proactive maintenance and error fixing, you name it, with a strong focus on SEO excellence, which is what gets you those hardcore top-of-the-list search engine rankings. But there is a difference. Innovatius works off a simple, all-inclusive monthly subscription model, as opposed to the typical outdated and confusing project model. So you never have to wonder how much any request for any work to be done on your website might cost. It's always $497 per month. And if that's not enough, if you've mentioned you've heard of their services on the Japan Real Estate Podcast, you'll also get 10% off this monthly price for life. Also, and equally important, if not more, you can try out Innovatius for just 1 month, then switch them off, on again later if you want, and so forth. There are no minimum subscription terms. Now, if you're a small business owner, managing and growing a website is super distracting and time-consuming, right? That's exactly where Innovatius comes in. Robert's team takes care of all of that for you so that you can focus on what you do best. So feel free to email Rob on robert@innovatius.com. And his team will conduct a full SEO and website audit on your site, reveal anything that you should address to increase your website's appeal, and provide you with an easy-to-read detailed report with your own branding so that you can make some informed decisions on your online strategy and watch your business grow as you implement it. So once more, robert@innovatius.com. Drop him a line and get your website reviewed today.
Yeah, and then also just when it comes to just being a college student right now, like, everything I'm doing right now is like, I've sort of like realized it was just a thought in my head of like, oh, what if I just moved to Japan one day? I'm like, oh, you know, I can actually make that reality. Right now, I'm starting with learning Japanese and just, I'm starting with hiragana, about to move on to kana, then like kanji and all that stuff too. So I was very curious when it comes, like, aside from studying Japanese, what's like the biggest thing you think I could like start doing right now to position myself to first like start at a company and then after a few years exit out and then start my own company. Like, what do you think is something I can start doing like right now, basically, to position myself for that future?
Well, to get hired in Japan, Japanese is going to be a huge thing, right? Mm-hmm. So there are some international IT companies, international banks and other financial services providers that do regularly hire people who are not fluent in Japanese because they just can't find the talent here. And also, they're a bit more of a global mindset, so they're open to it. But that's very much a minority. In most cases, if you want to find work in Japan, you will need to be fluent in Japanese. Mm-hmm. To set up a company is a little bit different. So to start your own thing, Japanese is going to be definitely helpful. But regardless of how well you speak the language, you're still going to be a foreigner who just recently came to Japan. So marketing to Japanese people, finding Japanese providers, suppliers, business partners, definitely if you're in the B2B space, that's all going to be very challenging regardless of your level of Japanese. In my experience, and my Japanese is nowhere near fluent. I mean, spoken Japanese is okay, but on a very casual kind of, you know how they have different speech for different environments, right?
The Keigo and all that?
The Keigo, yeah. So business Japanese is different. And even within Keigo, the way you would speak to a superior or a customer versus your colleague versus a subordinate is very different.
Yes.
So that's all beyond me. Kanji, I recognize the kanji that I work with on a regular basis, but I'm nowhere near fluent enough to be reading a newspaper or a book in Japanese. But For me, regardless of that, the biggest thing was to find a reliable Japanese business partner to be the Japanese face of the company. So for the real estate company, that's my wife. She handles the Japanese side of the business. I handle the customer side of the business. And we both manage interiorly, we both manage the staff, depending on which staff we're hiring independently. But not having a Japanese face to present to Japanese potential customers or business partners is going to be a no-no, regardless of your level of Japanese. So I guess speak, read, write Japanese is crucial when you want to get hired. If you want to start up your own business, it'll be a lot more important, regardless of what level of Japanese you have, a lot more important to find a Japanese business partner, or at least a senior salesperson or a senior channel management person who is native Japanese to represent you in front of the Japanese third parties or your Japanese customers, if that's who you're marketing to.
Then also, like, just from like your entire time, like you said, it's been like 2013 it was when you moved here, and then
Yep, no,
or
2013, yeah.
2013, yeah. So over like the past like 10 or so years, other than like I'm sure like in business, like everyone makes mistakes, but it's all about like how you respond to those mistakes and how you recover from them. So it's very curious, like what's
You
like
own them, I'd say, is the first thing.
on them? Okay, so like
Yeah,
what's
I
like
mean,
I
if you
guess.
don't take, if you're not accountable and you're either to yourself or to others, you don't admit that you made a mistake, you're not going to learn from it. Nothing's going to improve, right?
Course. And that, I guess I want to ask you, like, what's like kind of like the craziest mistake you've made, and like what did you do to, I guess, own that mistake and then like build from that?
Not a huge number, but I guess the first thing, both related to real estate. The new business is maybe a bit too young. We haven't made any major mistakes there yet. That's only 3 years. But with the real estate
Good.
side of things, the first set of properties that we bought personally before we even started the business was for our own investment. And I came in with a mentality that a lot of our customers do as well, is that I know real estate. I'm a seasoned investor. I know what I'm doing. Without even thinking for 1 second that things might be a little bit different in Japan compared to Australia, where I came from, where I was investing in. So we bought a bunch of properties. We saw that it was a set of three properties, all exact same sized units in the same condo block. All of them were tenanted and generating good yield. And us just looking at the Excel sheets and the numbers, we saw that one of the units is the rent is lower than the other two. And that unit, the lease was just about to expire, and that was the time where we needed to notify the tenant if we're going to be raising the rent. So we said, "Hey, raise the rent," to the property manager. We said, "Hey, raise the rent, make it, equal to the other two units." And him being Japanese, they will never directly confront you. So all you get from them is, "Are you sure that might not be such a good idea?" And they didn't clarify why. They were just really, really, again, conflict averse. They, maybe you shouldn't, maybe not a good idea. No, we know what we're doing. Raise the rent. We raised the rent. The tenant immediately didn't renew the lease and just moved out. We later found out that the rents that all of these units have been paying are pre-bubble rent. Pre-bubble days rent, right? They moved into the units, which is not uncommon in Japan. They were each living in the unit for a couple of decades. Pre-bubble days, post-bubble days, because everything, cost of living, rent, property prices, everything took a dive. So people were now paying for an average unit of, average comparable unit, people were paying about half the rent that they were paying back in bubble days. But the reason a Japanese tenant would never approach the landlord to ask for a discount or ask for reduced rent. They'll just keep paying whatever they signed up for, even if they could get a cheaper unit these days. And they prefer not to move. They prefer nothing to change in their lifestyle. And they definitely wouldn't approach the landlord to ask for a reduction. So they just keep paying the same rent forever. That particular tenant, as soon as we told them that we're raising the rent, they checked online, they saw that there are available units for half the rent, they moved out. And then it took us about a year and a half to find a new tenant, because that location, that's another thing we didn't know about, is when you're dealing with agents in Japan, they're honest, they're not going to swindle you, but they're not going to tell you what questions to ask. So we looked at the properties. It was in the city within Fukuoka Prefecture, but not Fukuoka City. It's called Kitakyushu. We didn't do any deep research about the city, and actually, as it turns out, a more stagnant population, more blue collar, far less attractive investment destination. explanation, but all we saw was the numbers and the yield, and it looked okay. The agent said, yeah, it's good yield. You want to buy it? Sure, why not? We bought it. Mm-hmm. And ends up being a case of you have to look for a year and a half to find a reliable tenant in that particular location, right?
Great.
So that was one mistake, which could have been avoided, number one, if we would have done some research, and number two, if we would have actually listened to the professionals who know their market and are working there, like the property manager, right?
Mm-hmm.
So that's maybe related to what you're asking about cultural. Another big mistake that we made, and that's just a business management mistake, is we didn't double check stuff. We had somebody working for us who was not super experienced. They did some property research on behalf of a client. We ended up purchasing the property for the client. And then when the tenant moved out the first time, which is about 6 months after the purchase, we suddenly recognized that even though our research guy marked the property as being within 5 or 7 minutes walk to a station, it's actually 15 minutes walk to the nearest station or 20 minutes, something like that. Doesn't sound like much, but in Japan, it's very hard to populate a unit that's not within 10-minute walking distance to a station, right?
Mm-hmm.
We ended up, again, looking for a tenant for about 6, 7, 8 months, recognized that we're not finding anyone. We ended up selling the unit on behalf of the client. Fortunately, we could sell it for approximately the same price that we purchased. We refunded all of our fees for the purchase and the sale. The sale we didn't even charge, but we refunded all of our purchase fees to the client. So they were not out of pocket at all, aside from the few months that they had to wait. And we, you know, we were a couple of $1,000s short. But again, not owning, everybody makes mistakes, right? Whatever you do, especially when you're new in business, you're definitely going to be making mistakes. And even down the track, if you're not new, even down the track, you might just make mistakes because shit happens, right?
Yeah.
Owning up to it and immediately taking action to amend it is the best way to move forward. Anything else will destroy your reputation very quickly.
Of course. And then also another part, when it comes to like cultural subtleties, like you mentioned a little bit, when it comes to like avoiding confrontation, another thing I've seen is, like, for example, like each region of Japan has different ways of sort of communicating subtleties. Like, I know, like Kyoto is specifically known for being like extremely indirect. Of like, I've heard an example where someone
passive aggressive, I'd call it. Yeah,
interesting. Yeah, and then like there was a shopkeeper that asked someone to leave, but instead of saying, "Hey, we're about to close, but I leave," they said, "Oh, that's a very nice watch you have," but then that also means like, "Please leave."
Yeah.
So I was curious, like. Like you talked about a little bit, but have you experienced that in any other parts of Japan? At least, I mean, once again, outside of the big cities like Tokyo, Kyoto, Osaka?
Countryside people are a lot more direct.
Mm-hmm.
Almost in a non-Japanese kind of way. Like they would look you in the face and say, "What are you doing here?" kind of thing. Like when you're somewhere that they don't expect you to be.
Mm-hmm.
Kyoto is, yes, very passive aggressive. You know, if you walk down the street and you stop to look at something or take a photo of something, then people walking around you say, "Oh, you got a lot of time on your hands, don't you?" Like they just you're in their way.
Mm-hmm.
Tokyo is, I guess, a little bit like New York in the sense that, you know, nobody looks you in the eye and nobody has time and everyone's just running around. You know, you fall down the street, not many people, unless they're elderly, not many people will, you know, even pause to look at what's wrong. Fukuoka, Osaka are a lot more casual, not direct, like countryside direct, but people seem to have more time on their hands. They're more open to engaging in small talk and conversation with strangers kind of thing. Other cities, I don't know. I mean, I'm hearing kind of cliches from people who are living there and know them, but I don't have that much experience living in any other city or going there as frequently. So I'm not sure.
Mm-hmm. Of course. And then also kind of like just like going, wait, that's, oh yeah, I see we're coming up an hour just really quick. I have plenty of time to continue talking. I just want to make sure. Do you still have time to continue talking?
I will need to go in about 5-10 minutes, so we can pick this up another time if you want.
All right. So I mean, I guess we continue for the next 5 minutes or so. I guess we can leave off on, like, on one last question. I guess it's a good one to leave it off on. But in the future, like, do you plan on staying like in Japan like your entire life, or do you want to end up like move to another country, go back to Australia, Israel, or have you thought about like kind of an end game plan, I should say?
That's another topic we can get into for a few hours. I try not to make financial plans ahead of time, thinking about, returns and what I might do with that investment in 10 years' time. But as far as personal life is concerned, I really don't plan more than a year ahead at best. I just had too many experiences in my life. Like I'm, divorced once, widowed once, had a child, ended up moving to another country, like stuff that I couldn't even imagine when I was growing up, that where I'd be, both geographically and in my life, So I try not to make personal plans. I can tell you what I feel now. I think that Japan will always be a home base. Israel, I love with all my heart, but it's not a place where I want to live, to be honest, unless there's some drastic changes, but I don't feel that's going to be the case. If anything, it's getting worse. Australia, I love, but I never had a deep connection to the people there. I mean, I have a few good Australian friends, but they're very on the outskirts. Like most of my friends were expats, and the country itself is gorgeous. Like, I love going there. My mom still lives there. I love going there. I love driving through the countryside. Australia is like endless nature everywhere. It's breathtaking. But living there is a bit boring for me personally, I found. Even central Sydney, central Melbourne, if it's not the weekend, everything kind of closes after 6 p.m. It's kind of tumbleweed, except hotel bars and stuff like that. And the food is nothing to write home about. Like, the meat is amazing, but that's about it. Japan ticks a lot more of these boxes for me. It's as safe and comfortable, and they give you space as Australia is, but the food is much better and everything is alive at any hour of the day and night, at least in the cities, obviously not in the countryside, but any big city in Japan will be lively throughout the week, 24 hours a day kind of thing. And I need that. Like, I find that I prefer to live close to a city and visit the countryside than the other way around. My last 2 years in Australia, we lived in a very beautiful, tiny little country town, and we just couldn't handle it after about a year, right?
I see.
So I see myself staying in Japan, but definitely the 6 months here, 6 months other places thing is going to be the thing. But that's how I'm feeling now. I can't tell you in a year or 5 years' time.
Of course, yeah. I mean, I'm sort of like even like very early in my life, I've kind of noticed that like if you told me, oh yeah, I'll be studying in Indiana, like doing business and now going to Korea, Japan, and like all these places in the future, I always said like there's no way. I thought I'd be playing music like full time or something like that. So no, I definitely do
I
see
mean,
that. Of
we're living creatures. We change every minute, let alone every
course.
year. I don't know what I'll be into. I don't know what will happen in my life. I don't know what the world will get to, like macro things that are way beyond my control. So I don't, I guess I try to leave myself open to opportunities as they occur, and then everything might change. I have no idea.
That's interesting. And okay, just be respectful of your time. It seems like this is about the end for us, so
This
once
is fun. We can do a part two, definitely.
again, of course, I'd love to. No, genuinely. But yeah, once again, genuinely, thank you so much. Genuinely learned a lot, especially about Fukuoka and just the overall business in Japan and all that, especially in real estate. So yeah, I mean, I'd love to speak to you again one day in the future, but yeah, thank you. Of
Sounds good. Thanks for your time. Talk to you soon.
course.
So there you have it. Potentially a lot more than you ever wanted to know about your host. Sorry about that. But hopefully with some good nuggets or insights in there for you as well. Let me know what you think. Drop me a line, or better yet, come talk to me at the summit next week at the Tokyo International Forum. I'll also be dropping into the streaming chat channel throughout the weekend whenever I can. So feel free to catch me here or there and let me know what you thought about it. Now, before we go, we're also, as always, going to tell you and also link to our other sponsor's website. That's Hiroshi Shimizu, immigration lawyer and administrative scrivener. If you're thinking about moving here on a more permanent basis, or you're already in Japan on some sort of a temporary visa and you want to switch to a longer term or permanent one, or if you're considering setting up a local company or a branch office of a foreign company and you've got any sort of business or visa-related inquiries, or even if you just want to find out what your options are on any of these topics, feel free to contact Hiroshi Shimizu. You can find him at japanimmigrationexperts.com, and he can help you set up a company, apply for any kind of visa, or just provide you with the best advice and extremely affordable consultation related to these topics. And he's already done that for many of our listeners. So feel free to reach out to him. Again, that's japanimmigrationexperts.com, and you'll be well on your way. And that's it from us for today, folks. Hope you've enjoyed this episode of the Japan Real Estate Podcast. Do share it with your networks and please let us know what you think. So leave us a short rating or review on the iTunes Store, on Spotify, or just drop us a line in the comment section of wherever you might have found this episode. We love hearing from you. Hope to have you with us again next time. And until then, have a great day or night ahead. Yoshiku.